The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before.
This great nation will endure as it has endured. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Freedom and the dignity of the individual have been more available and assured here than in any other place on earth.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
We're not, as some would have us believe, doomed to an inevitable decline. I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
From every mountainside, let freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring.
As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it, now or ever. We are Americans.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. Here's your host, Bob Frantz.
Yes, indeed, and a good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us as we get rolling at 11 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock on this Wednesday, the seventh morning of the month of Groom in the year of our Lord, 2023. They are grooming your children, if you did not know. So we've got a lot to talk about this morning, and a lot of opportunities to do that talking. We are cleared for the first 2 hours. Jack Windsor will join me in the third hour of the broadcast at about 11:10. We have a lot to discuss going on in Columbus right now. But that's not until 11:10. So that means for the first 2 hours, plenty of opportunities for you to be heard and to ask questions, make comments about all of the top news of the day. And I look forward to that. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. Either one of those numbers will get you where you need to be. And that is in touch with me. So looking forward to that. Now, I want to say I'm so happy to have learned this. I have been castigating all of Major League Baseball for, you know, the last couple of weeks since we learned about the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, a group that I had never heard of before this year, this anti-Catholic hate group that is going to be honored with a Community Hero Award by the L.A. Dodgers. I have continued to say all of Major League Baseball is complicit because baseball has to approve these kinds of promotions, right? So all of MLB is complicit, and I said, besides, it's going to happen, maybe not with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence Catholic anti-Catholic hate group, but they're going to do these Pride Night things in all of the ballparks. And I didn't know this until yesterday, but I know it now, and that's that I might have a new favorite baseball team, because there is only one of the 30 teams in MLB that has said, we will not be doing Pride Night. Not just not doing it with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, just at all. We're not doing it. And that team is the Texas Rangers. The Texas Rangers, as I understand it, have never hosted a single drag queen award ceremony. They haven't celebrated transgender activists, and they have never done a pride night. And I'll tell you what, that makes me a fan of the Texas Rangers. It's not to say I'm going to try to buy an MLB package so I can tune in their games, but I will be a fan from afar. I will be a fan because I appreciate their courage and their willingness to take whatever slings and arrows are going to come from the LGBTQ community their way, calling them bigots, calling them prejudice, calling them gay homophobes, gay bashers, transphobes, all the different terms that they use. And they're willing to do that. The only Major League Baseball team not having a Pride Night is the Texas Rangers. Although last year they did have a Pride Night, but it was Charlie Pride Night. And I love Charlie Pride. If you're an old school country music fan from the 70s or so, you know Charlie Pride. They had a Charlie Pride Night, and that's it. Next Impulse Sports reported, June is Pride Month for the LGBTQ community, which of course we call groom. Not June. As a result, many Major League Baseball teams across the country are planning to host Pride Night celebrations at the ballpark or similar promotions that celebrate the LGBTQ plus community. But one team has made it clear that they will not hold such a celebration, the Texas Rangers. And by the way, before I continue, doesn't it strike anybody as just bizarre that all of these teams are going to have one of these, you know, with the exception of the Rangers? That line that said, baseball teams across the country are planning Pride Night celebrations or promotions that sell. How does baseball intersect with sexual orientation? I just totally out of curiosity, why would the sexual attraction that some people feel in any way, shape, or form intersect with baseball? Why does baseball need to hold Pride Nights? Why did hockey host Pride Nights even outside of the month of groom? I'm just curious as to why that ever became a thing. I understand communities that want to do certain things, but there's a lot of communities that would probably love to have their own blank night at the ball yard or blank night at the hockey game. There's a lot of community, and they don't get them. I'm wondering how the LGBTQ community got them. Hey, we like aberrant sex. Give us a night at the ball yard so people can applaud us for the pleasures that we seek. That's just super. Anyway, while every other major league team across baseball has held a Pride Night or similar promotional event, the Dallas Morning News reports that the Texas Rangers have not hosted a promotion to welcome and celebrate the LGBTQ in over two decades. Back in 2003, the team did invite several groups to the ballpark, according to The Advocate, but was not officially marketed as any specific promotion and was met with anti-gay protests. The team has not hosted a similar event since then. Despite a push from the LGBTQ leaders in the Dallas community, the Rangers have thus far refused to host a promotional game for the LGBTQ community and does not have one planned for this season. It does not sound like they plan to host a Pride Night or similar event in the future either. Quote from the COO of the Rangers, Neil Liebman. With respect to Pride Night, we reached out to the Resource Center and said what we can do internally. We immediately adopted some changes and suggested to be more inclusive in hiring practices. I think that's more meaningful than just saying, okay, we had a Pride Night. So there you go. And as far as hiring goes, there should never be any kind of discrimination based on those kinds of things anyway. So they can hire who they want, but they are not going to do something in the ball yard. And you know who appreciates that more than anybody? I think, my personal opinion, it's not you, me, or the fans. It's the players. The players in these sports are sick and tired of being made to participate in things that they may or may not agree with. Even if they agree with it, many of them don't want to participate because they don't want to push it on other fans who don't. They want to play baseball or hockey or whatever it is that they play. and they feel being made to wear the rainbow warm-ups or whatever it is that they're using to advance their little pride nights, they feel like that is giving a de facto endorsement of the cause and maybe even of the grooming that we are so concerned about. Let me fast forward now to another sport and another case in point. The Columbus Blue Jackets of the National Hockey League have just made a trade. They've traded for Ivan Provorov, who is was a player with the Philadelphia Flyers, a defenseman. And you think, why are we giving trade reports on hockey on Always Right Radio? Well, because there's a little bit more to this. Headline, LGBTQ, this is in the Columbus Dispatch, some LGBTQ plus fans frustrated with Columbus Blue Jackets trade for Ivan Provorov. And the reason why, of course, is Ivan Provorov was one of the few hockey players who refused back in January to wear a Pride Night jersey when he played for the Flyers. Ivan Provorov cited his religion and his beliefs in not wanting to participate in this. And that has the ever-so-tolerant LGBTQ community in a tizzy. It's a positive snit. They were so angry they wanted the Flyers to bench and to, yes, cut or trade Ivan Provorov. Now, it took 6 months to do it, but they finally did trade Ivan Provorov. Did they do so for hockey reasons or for upset left-wing Philadelphia fan reasons? Don't know. But what we do know is that he is now a Columbus Blue Jacket, and according to the Dispatch, a lot of Blue Jacket fans are upset. In Philadelphia, he refused to participate in the warm-ups on January 17th because the rest of the Flyers wore Pride Night jerseys and rainbow-colored stick tape to support the LGBTQ community before a game. Provorov is a Russian Orthodox person who said he chose to, quote, stay true to myself and my religion, end quote, while not participating. His reasoning was met with hate on social media. He was called a bigot. He was said to be prejudiced. The Columbus Blue Jackets, in trading for Provorov, says, we have always been an organization that promotes inclusion and diversity and all those things. Hockey is for everyone, but we also respect freedom of opinion and freedom of choice. What a remarkable idea to the Columbus Blue Jackets, I say.
Can you dig it?
How about that? A little bit of reason and common sense. They said, we're not an organization that cancels anybody as long as you're a law-abiding citizen, and we have a long and good history on promoting all, quote, those things. Our organization supports inclusion and diversity, and we're going to continue to do so. But Columbus LGBTQ community leaders, well, they're not having it. Zach Boyer, Director of Community Programs and Marketing at Stonewall Columbus, some sort of an LGBT advocacy group, told the Dispatch that the Columbus Blue Jacket leadership is making it clear who they align with. They align with bigots. Boyer said, no one is being canceled and their values are in opposition to an employer standing in solidarity with a marginalized community. That's called sticking to your values as an organization. Who is the marginalized community here, especially in the month of June? Who is the marginalized community? The LGBTQ community, which gets free rein to do anything they want, anything in the name of pride, or the straight, normal communities that have to accept it, no matter how wrong it is, no matter how perverted it is, no matter how repugnant it might be. And I'm talking about the BDSM parades and so forth that are going through our city streets. Who is marginalized? Not the LGBT community that pushes and promotes and sells and gives away sex toys to children at these events. No, they're not marginalized. They have full reign. The marginalized are people who say, I don't like that. We're the ones who then end up being canceled. We're the ones who end up, Ivan Provorov is the one who ends up being attacked. So who is really marginalized here? Boyer said, Pride Nights and other events that celebrate LGBT folks are more than a moment of celebration. If it's done with the right intent, you're saying you stand with us. But this solidarity, why do we need to stand with anybody based on what types of people they like to have sex with? I don't have to make a stand for or against that. Go live your life and leave the rest of us alone, right? But Boyer said of Provorov, quote, by hiring a bigot and then doubling down with a statement like that speaks volumes to how truly out of touch CBJ leadership must be. Otherwise, they would be see the cognitive dissonance of their actions. Other fans said, I've got some serious thinking to do about my season tickets after this move, bringing on what they call a bigot to play hockey for them. So are LGBTQ folks like myself going to be still welcome at Nationwide Arena? One asked, because this kind of feels like a bit of a setback because they picked up in a trade a hockey player who said that I'm going to stand by my religion. You know what this sounds like? It sounds to me like the LGBTQ community, the ones that call themselves marginalized, they are the ones that are marginalizing people of religion, people of faith, people whose faith precludes them from celebrating other people's sexual proclivities. Who is really marginalized? Who is really in danger here? Ivan Provorov, the new defenseman for the Blue Jackets in Columbus, is just a hockey player who has a faith that says, I don't do that sort of thing. That makes him a bigot, and it makes the Blue Jackets, who hired him and traded for him, an organization full of bigots, according to the LGBTQ community. So here's what I would ask you. Where's the tolerance? Remember that word? Used to be a big word in the LGBTQ community. We demand tolerance. Tolerance from the intolerant bigots. Tolerate our lifestyle. Well, Ivan Provorov is a Russian Orthodox Christian who does not want to participate in your celebrations. Where is your tolerance for him? Where's your tolerance for other points of view? The reality is these organizations, we're not talking about every LGBTQ member. We're talking about the organizations that run these things, that make up these nights, that celebrate these events and host them and so forth. These organizations are the most intolerant people in the country. If you aren't marching with them, you are branded a bigot. Mr. Provorov never said a negative word about a gay person, not that anyone knows, about a bi person, an L person, a T person, a Q person, a B person, or any of the other alphabet letters that they've put together. He has never said a negative thing about any of them. And that used to be the barometer for deciding whether or not somebody is a bigot. Did they say bigoted things? Did they take bigoted actions? He did not. All he did was sit out the warm-ups so he didn't have to wear the pride stuff. So suddenly, it's not about committing, it's not about an act of commission of hate or intolerance against a group. It's an act of omission. You didn't stand up and march with us. Therefore, you are the bigot. Do you see how dangerous that mindset is? It demands not just compliance, but it demands active promotion of whatever the cause might be. And it's so dangerous because if it's allowed for the LGBTQ community, Lord knows what next. We're going to be compelled to promote, and just sitting silent and not bashing something is not enough to prove you as a non-bigot. You have to actively promote that thing or else you wear the label bigot. That's what Ivan Provorov is doing. So there's a lot of grist for the mill there. I welcome your thoughts. 216-901-045, 888-281-1110. Before we take our break, let's do our Pledge of Allegiance. Patriots, stand and face your flag. Put your hand on your heart and join us. If you are a believer in any of that nonsense I just described, you're exempt from the request. Here is our pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
928, we'll get some news. We'll come back. I've got open lines for you at 216-901-0945 on Always Right Radio. One man to overthrow.
depravity of the radical left. Always Right Radio with Bob France on The Answer.
Okay, 9:36. Appreciate you being with us on this Wednesday morning. Jack Windsor going to be with us in the third hour. The first 2 hours are yours at 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. I want to get right to some calls because I've got a lot of other stories, but I don't want to make you sit there too terribly long. I want to go to Hudson. Amy in Hudson has got some thoughts on the Pride Night story. Amy, good morning. Go right ahead.
Program a little bit late, so I apologize if you have already mentioned this, mm-hmm. but the I heard a rumor from my husband that the Guardians will be having a Pride night on Friday, this coming Friday. So, did you already mention that?
No, not recently. I did know that they had it coming. I mentioned it like last week when I was talking about the Dodgers situation. Their Pride night is on the 16th, I think, and I mentioned then that the Indians is on the 9th. So, but yeah, it's coming right up, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And when I heard it, I thought of going down there by myself. I don't know anybody else who might go. But I have an idea for a sign, and the sign would say, a poster, one of those things. Woke, that's W-O-K-E in large letters. Woke is a nightmare that'll destroy USA. If you look at history, the country of Greece, I understand, became woke in their later years, and they lost power and their position in the world. Also, Italy. And many other countries have succumbed to this idea, and they have lost status and they're not as strong as they used to be. So looking at it from a historical point of view, I think it is it's a disaster, like a nightmare.
I think you're 100% right. And yes, many of the great civilizations and countries of the past did. It certainly wouldn't be referred to as wokeness back then, but some of the same things that lead us that we call woke now did beguile them, and it did lead to their ultimate downfalls. And
exactly.
Yeah. And you're spot on about what's going to, and Amy, thank you for the call. I appreciate it very much. You're spot on about it destroying the United States. Wokeism, if you will, this belief in victimization at all turns, everybody, you know, critical theory plays a huge role in wokeism. Creating oppressors and those who are oppressed, the marginalized versus the privileged, and so on and so forth. It is absolutely designed to take down this country brick by brick. There's no mistaking it. And by the way, if you are anti-woke, you apparently are also anti-black. This according to a black representative, member of the squad. Cori Bush from Missouri, one of the most virulent race baiters, I think, in the Congress, yesterday said that Republicans who consider themselves anti-woke are actually labeling themselves as anti-black. She said this during a House Oversight Committee hearing. So if you're against the woke nature of embracing the LGBTQ community, embracing the trans community, if you're not drinking Bud Light anymore because of the because of what they did and the partnership they forged with a groomer, that Target, which is trying to put little boys in little girls' swimsuits sufficient with tuck area for their penises in their girls' swimsuits. If you oppose those things, that makes you anti-woke, and that also makes you a racist, according to Cori Bush. During a House Committee on Oversight and Accountability hearing, she pointed to the extremely frequent use of the word wokeness among Republican leaders and said those who fixate on establishing themselves as anti-woke are actually saying, I don't want black people to speak up for themselves. I don't want equality and justice for black folks, end quote. It should go without saying, you know, the obvious here is that what the hell are you talking about, equality and justice? What is there that black Americans cannot have or do in this country right now that white people or non-black people can? We already have equality. You don't want equality, Representative Bush. You don't want equality. You want equity. You want handouts. You want favoritism. You want preferred treatment because of past mistakes made in this republic. You don't want equality. You want equity and outcome, regardless of the effort that it takes to get there and earn it. Being against wokeness means being for equality. Equality of opportunity for everyone. Every white kid, every black kid, every Latino kid, every Asian kid, every ethnic European kid, every ethnic South American kid, anybody that's in this country legally should have the same opportunity. Raised by good families, educated, not with discrimination, but with equal opportunity for all, and then the ability to potentially get into a trade, go to work, go to the military, go to college, which should be kind of far down on the list anymore, given the cost of it and what they're doing in the colleges. But at any rate, everybody has the same equal opportunities. The laws apply equally. The opportunities apply equally. As a matter of fact, the reality is there are more opportunities for people of color in this country today than there are for people who are white majority. I remember when my daughter was searching for scholarship opportunities before she went to Hillsdale. I remember going through the scholarship lists with her. And you know what I found among the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scholarships available? I found dozens and dozens of dozens that were exclusively for people of color. You know how many I found that were exclusively for people who are white? Zero. Nil, nada, none, as it should be. But just as that should be, there should not have been specifically scholarships only for people of color. So don't tell me that there isn't equality and justice in this country. As a matter of fact, it's bending over backwards to go in the other direction. But they say that if you're anti-woke and thus anti-grooming month and so on and so forth, it means you're a racist. You're anti-black. Simply unbelievable. She said, quote, it was astounding how often the term wokeness is used from people who have no idea what woke actually means and where it stems from. She pointed to the case of Michael Brown, who was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, and that's in her district, in 2014. I'm one of those folks that was on the ground for more than 400 days after the killing of Michael Brown when that came about. We said we woke up because we won't allow anyone else to do this to us without fighting back. Do I have to do this? I kind of feel like because of that line, and I had not seen that line before just now, my apologies, I didn't read the entire story, I only read the first two paragraphs to know that I wanted to share this with you. If I have to do this, I will. And it looks like I am going to have to do this. The Michael Brown story must be retold. The Michael Brown story must be refreshed in the minds of people because of people like, well, Representative Cori Bush. If you don't know what really happened, and you should, we were talking about this in 2014, 2015, 2016. That's when this show started, by the way, right here on AM 1420, The Answer. This is when this show started. But we were talking about this then, and I went to great lengths to tell everybody what the reality of the Michael Brown story was. But since that has been now in the rearview mirror for, what, about 9 years or so, let's refresh by way of Prager University. This is a very short clip, short portion, I should say, of a video of PragerU that intends to tell the truth and remind you of exactly what the mainstream media and liars like Cori Bush don't want you to know, the truth. I want you to listen.
Michael Brown was a young black teenager, a gentle giant, who on August 9th, 2014, during a routine police stop in Ferguson, Missouri, raised his hands and pleaded for his life as he looked down the barrel of racist white police officer Darren Wilson's gun. Brown famously held his hands up and yelled, "Don't shoot," before he turned and ran. Wilson shot him 6 times in the back, killing him dead. If you bought that, you bought a lie. Here are the facts. Michael Brown was 6'4". He weighed 292 pounds. 80 pounds heavier than Officer Wilson. He was a giant, but there was nothing gentle about him. Brown and his friend had just robbed a convenience store. Wilson, in his police car, spotted them walking in the middle of the street. The two men matched the description of the thieves. Wilson drove up and told them to move to the sidewalk. Brown refused, blocked Wilson from opening his car door, punched the officer through the open window, and reached for Wilson's gun. Wilson fired in self-defense, striking Brown's hand. Brown ran. Wilson got out of the car and pursued him. Brown then suddenly turned and charged Wilson. Wilson repeatedly told him to stop, but Brown kept coming. Wilson shot Brown until Brown collapsed. A local grand jury and federal investigators from the Obama Justice Department concluded that Officer Wilson was justified in his use of deadly force. There is no evidence that Brown ever held his hands up and yelled, "Don't shoot." The whole story was manufactured by the media. It wasn't the first time. It wouldn't be the last. Not by a long shot.
The whole story was manufactured by the media, and it is the lie continues 9 years on, coming out of the mouths of people like Cori Bush. Racist Representative Cori Bush from Missouri. She continues the lie 9 years later to prove that Republicans somehow prove that Republicans are racist if they're anti-woke. It's just really an astounding thing, and just to kind of refresh and to embellish a little bit on what the video just talked about, it was the Eric Holder Department of Justice that came to Missouri to conduct investigation after investigation after investigation. You see, the local investigations which cleared Darren Wilson were certainly not enough. The state investigations that cleared Darren Wilson were not enough. So they said, let's get them with the feds. That's how we'll get them. Let's send in Eric Holder and have his team investigate, and we'll get him on violation of Michael Brown's civil rights for shooting him in the back with his hands up and said, don't shoot. So here comes Eric Holder prancing in. We'll get him. If ever there was a motivation for a Department of Justice to find something, because you remember the riots, right, after the Michael Brown incident, not quite on the scale of George Floyd, but not minor by any means. If ever there was a time they were motivated to find something to pin Michael Brown's death on this white cop that they so badly wanted to be the murderer, that was the time. And here comes Eric Holder and his DOJ doing investigations, multiple federal investigations. And how about that? Wouldn't you know? Everything that you were told by the media was indeed a lie. It happened exactly as you just heard it in that Prager University video. He attacked the officer while he was in the car. Then when he got out of the car, he ran directly at the officer with his 6'4", 290-pound frame. And Officer Darren Wilson shot him as he was being attacked. The DOJ came up with the same results that the local and statewide investigations did. But they're still using Michael Brown as evidence of a racist country, a racist police force, a country that owes people like Cori Bush reparations. We're still using that as evidence of the systemic racism of America. That lets you know how just truly radical and ridiculous these people are. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. More calls right after this. It is 9:54. I'm going to get a couple more calls in here, though. I am very, very tempted to transition to a story that literally just came down yesterday that would make the that would do the Darren Wilson story proud. Cops, it's open season. Let's phrase it that way. I'm going to have to share that story with you after the top of the hour. It's open season on cops after a jury verdict in California acquitted a mentally ill person who fired, who attacked, punched, tackled and then took the gun from a female deputy who was responding to a call to remove this individual from his mother's home. His mother said that he was dangerous and violent, and she called to have him removed. The female deputy who responded was attacked by this guy who took her gun and shot at her. This happened in 2019. Yesterday, this suspect was acquitted.
What?
Yeah, I'm going to have to tell you that story. But first, let's go to some more phone calls. Derek has been waiting in Richfield. Derek, you're on AM 1420, The Answer. Go ahead, Derek.
Hey, morning, Bob. Thank you. So, yeah, with D-Day being yesterday, I wasn't able to call in, but I wanted to know, are you aware, do you know about D-Day Canyon?
Not sure I do.
Okay, so every year, the largest World War II reenactment in the country is held up in Conneaut, Ohio, up in Ashtabula, right on Lake Erie. Mm-hmm. And we went to it last year. It is, I'm talking, there could be up to 12 to 1,400 reenactors. And it's a weekend of living history. The website is letter D, day, ohio.us. And it's a free event. You just have to register. The equipment, there were probably a dozen, fully operational tanks. Someone had a fully restored German Panzer tank that he was operating and firing blanks during one of the battles. There are four narrated reenacted battles. It was just, phenomenal. There were different camps set up. There's, the SS camps, German officer camps, French resistance, British airborne, the U.S. camps. Meta camps, and it was it was so exciting and even to still talk about it.
Sounds amazing. They do it every year. When
it's every year, so I don't know why it's not in June, closer to the actual D-Day. This year is August 17th through 19th. It's pretty much the same, every day. There are food trucks. It's a big event,
right?
There are tens of thousands of people that come for the weekend, and
Well, I was just going to say, I'm glad to learn about it, and I'm glad to share it, too, and we'll get it out over the airwaves and let people know that it's there, because it sounds like a great event. It sounds like an incredible experience, and I'm really glad to know of it. I might have to set some time aside myself to come up there in August. Give me that website again.
So it's D-Day, Ohio.us.
D-Day, Ohio. .us, did you say that?
.us. Yeah, .us. Okay. You'll find on YouTube videos and things. They have the highlighted battle is the Normandy Beach invasion.
Sure.
The whole beach is spread out. With this big Yugoslavian hedgehogs, to stop the tanks, like this big giant jack, berms and foxholes. But there's a big bluff overlooking the beach. So the pontoon boats are dropping U.S. soldiers dressed up on the beach, and they have to storm take the beach, get the bunkers. And there are actually two, World War II era planes flying over, swooping over during the whole battle. The old Sherman tanks are blasting blanks out of the cannons. And I took my three girls with me, and they loved it. It's loud, dude. The earmuffs is a smart thing, or earplugs, because they're fighting blanks all day.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
But so for the kids, it was like an Easter egg hunt, going around picking up all the brass shells from the casings from all after the battles. It was a lot of fun.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, Derek, thank you, my friend. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the information. D-Day, Ohio.us. I'll take a look at it myself, and I'll encourage other people to do so as well. It sounds like a really, really great thing to experience. I appreciate that. It's coming up on 10 o'clock news.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
Hour number two underway now, 9 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Wednesday, the seventh morning of the month of Groom of the year, in the year of our Lord, 2023. So I'm going to get a phone call in here first, because I don't want to keep people waiting too terribly long, and then I'm going to tell you the story that you need to hear. Again, as we talk about how cops are under attack and how this is a direct result of the BLM and Antifa riots. and the communities that decided to defund police, and that policing everywhere had to be changed and reimagined and more because of George Floyd, and prior to that because of Michael Brown and so on and so forth. I got a very important story for you. But first, Phil on AM 1420, The Answer, wants to get in and talk about Disney a little bit, and that's fine with me. Phil, go right ahead, sir.
Hey, good morning, Bob. We got on the Bob France Experience by listening to the Dr. Gorka show when you hosted for him, like as a guest host, and we've been hooked ever since. So it's really fun listening to you, like, alternately in the morning.
That's awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
You're very welcome. I just had a question about Disney and get your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Since Disney went wokey woke and tranny train and all that, how the heck are they still in operation in Shanghai, China, the biggest populous city in China overall, and they have their Disney park out there? How are the communists putting up with this? Why are the communists putting up with this?
That's a really good question. You know, first of all, the Chinese Communist Party is willing to bend their beliefs and the rules if it's going to benefit them. And if you think about how much money, and so is Disney. See, it's kind of like the NBA. Quite frankly, you know, the NBA is all woke and the NBA is all rainbowed and everything else too, but the NBA has a massive, massive presence in China. They're both willing to compromise whatever their principles are in order to make money. At the end of the day, it is all about profit. And it's bizarre to think that communists would be so capitalistic in their view of this, but they are. The reality is they are. They know how much money trade with the United States, in particular with organizations that can put massive numbers of people in their investors in China, in their investors' books, if you will. And I'm talking about the NBA, and I'm talking about the corporations that partner with them and have their products made there. And yeah, Disney too. They have slave labor camps in China. They have concentration camps in which Uyghur Muslims are tortured and executed regularly, and yet we have people here in the United States talking about looking toward protect the oppressed people who are here.
Right.
So Disney, the NBA, they're all hypocrites. They're willing to do business with a foreign country like China, a communist China-like country, if it lines their pockets. Again, whether they're no matter whether they believe in capitalism or they don't, they certainly believe in getting their share.
Right, and just real quick, Chris Christie announced that he's going to run for president. Two, 3 weeks ago, he said that DeSantis should leave Disney alone. Disney should be able to operate it. And as far as what we heard, was this guy's back in Disney to sexualize our children. He doesn't have a prayer. I mean, here in Jersey, over in Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy started a gender studies program that's introduced as of this September that just passed to kindergarten through high school.
Of course he did.
There's people over there.
That's on brand for Phil Murphy and the far left, and that's true. But to Christie, real quick, what you just said is troubling, but you know what? You know who else said the same thing about DeSantis should have left Disney alone? Donald Trump. Donald Trump. President Trump sided with Disney against Ron DeSantis 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. He ripped Ron DeSantis for going after Disney, saying that going after Disney caused Disney to abandon that massive expansion they were going to do. So it cost 2,000 jobs to Floridians and so forth. So he took Disney's side up until people got into his ear and told him how terribly weak that was in terms of polling, that people sided, conservative voters sided with DeSantis on this. And so then he flipped and said the exact opposite and said Ron DeSantis should have taken out Disney a long time ago. Should have done it earlier.
Because everything was taken out of context. I love when politicians do that.
Yeah.
They cleared it up for us.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. Thank you for listening in Philadelphia there. I appreciate that, Phil. God bless. Appreciate you very much. For a second there, I thought maybe it was a prank call because it was Phil in Philly. But no, he heard me on Gorka, and that was wonderful. No, that's a very frustrating thing. Chris Christie did announce, I haven't even talked about it today because he's a non-factor in this, except for getting in the way. And he will. He'll get in the way. He'll pull some votes from Trump. He'll pull some votes from DeSantis. He'll pull some, not enough to be a player himself, but he will just be one of the many obstacles in getting to where we need to be, with our nominee. But yeah, he did. He criticized DeSantis for taking on Disney, and so did Donald Trump. And it's one of the most frustrating things that I can even imagine. and that I've talked about. You know, Donald Trump literally said Ron DeSantis shouldn't have taken on Disney. Then when he found out how bad he was polling in that particular area, that issue, he said Ron DeSantis screwed up because he should have stopped Disney from going woke years ago. Disney went woke while Ron DeSantis was governor, he said, in the last 4 years, and DeSantis should have stopped it. Wait, what? How in the living world do those two things compute? How can you say he shouldn't have done it at all and then come back and say he should have done it a lot sooner? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's one of the reasons, by the by, that we absolutely must have the debates. And President Trump needs to be involved. Those conversations need to happen. Those head-to-heads need to happen. Somebody needs to ask him, which is it? You know, during the entire three-year run of COVID, President Trump praised Ron DeSantis, as did the rest of the country, for being one of the strongest states to resist lockdowns. They did it much later than everybody else. They were resistant to it some 30 days after President Trump actually and Dr. Fauci issued the nationwide advisement to close things down. 30 days later, DeSantis finally did it, and then he opened it up within like 2 weeks. Because he did not want to do it, and he hated the fact that they did. Anyway, the point is, Trump praised DeSantis for his COVID handling, and now that he's running against him, of course, he has ripped him for his COVID handling, saying on alternate days that he didn't lock down enough because he had more deaths than they had in New York City. And then on a different day, saying Ron DeSantis was heavy-handed and locked down the state of Florida, unlike a lot of other good governors did. Like, wait, what? Which is it? Did he have too many deaths because he didn't take it seriously enough, or was he too heavy-handed and taking it too serious and locking down? Which one is it? Those conversations need to be held. They need to be held on a debate stage. Trump needs to be a part of that conversation. DeSantis needs to be a part of that conversation. Tim Scott and the other major players who are in this thing need to be. I don't even know how many major players there are. The rest of them are a bunch of minor players for the most part. Vivek Ramaswamy is a minor player. Nikki Haley is a minor player. Chris Christie is a minor player. Who else is it? Asa Hutchinson is a minor player. Larry Elder is not even being talked about. I don't know if he would qualify for the debate stage. I love Larry, you know that. But this was always a long shot, and it is what it is. But the big names, the heavy hitters, need to be on that debate stage in August. August 23rd, the first one is scheduled. It needs to happen, and President Trump needs to commit to it. So far, to my understanding, he has not committed to it, and we'll see where that goes. Okay, let me take a time out here so I can come back fresh and tell you about that other story. It's just a perfect segue from the Michael Brown story that Cori Bush, Representative Cori Bush, just brought back up in order to try to claim that Republicans are racist because they're not sufficiently woke. If you're anti-woke, you're anti-black, and Michael Brown somehow, she said, proves it. So I'm going to share a different story with you about open season on police and what this means going forward on Always Right Radio. Okay, it's 10:23. So I want to let this story be told a little bit by the deputy herself. Now, I was just talking about this because of Cori Bush going back to the Michael Brown story, claiming that the police officer was at fault for shooting Michael Brown as he stood there innocently, hands up, don't shoot, hands up, don't shoot, and all that other crap. Remember the NBA wore their warm-up jerseys, LeBron James and the Miami Heat at the time? Wore their warm-up jerseys before games saying, hands up, don't shoot. They shoot. They came out of the tunnel with their hands up, all mimicking the lie and the attempt to demonize the police officer in that case. Well, it failed, but it worked. It failed in that Officer Darren Wilson was found not guilty, or in fact not liable, rather, never even stood charges, because the investigations, all of them, local, state, and federal, proved that the entire hands up, don't shoot thing was a lie. And so it was successful in that Darren Wilson did not face charges, but it was also, or excuse me, it failed in that way, but it was successful in that it drove him into hiding. It's been 9 years, nobody's heard from Darren Wilson. He's probably living with his family under an assumed name because he was under constant threat of death from BLM and others. Anyway, It brings me to this. This is where our country is when particularly people like Cori Bush play the race card and say that if you're anti-woke, then you are anti-black and you are racist. It kind of ties all this together. This is a former San Bernardino County, that's California, sheriff's deputy, who was attacked violently by somebody she was responding to remove from a home and shot at, and then just found out that her attacker was being acquitted. It basically means that it's legal to fight with, attack, disarm, and then shoot at officers without being charged. It's legal to do that, at least in California. This is Gavin Newsom's California, but I want to let the deputy herself tell you the story, as well as this news report from Channel 4 in Victorville, California.
A portion of me had accepted that I was about to be murdered.
All new at 6, sworn to serve and protect, but it was a call for help that left a San Bernardino sheriff's deputy in need of help herself, and all of it caught on video. Thanks for joining us, everyone. I'm Carolyn Johnson. You can see here a man overpowering that deputy during a fight, taking her baton and gun. And tonight, for the first time, we are hearing from the deputy who survived the attack, what she says happened, and the man on the other end of it now found not guilty. Investigative reporter Eric Leonard joins us now with her story. Eric.
Now, before you hear the rest of the story, I'm watching that video, and I can tell you, and I know you're listening on radio, so you can't really picture this, but this individual easily overpowered this female deputy. Easily. He was punching her in the face till she fell to the ground. He jumped on her, took her gun, took her baton. It's very violent. It's very graphic, and it's very evident that she should have shot him before he even got on her. But why didn't she? Because hands up, don't shoot. Because every police officer involved shooting, particularly if somebody who is a minority, is viewed through a racial lens. She would have been probably imprisoned had she shot the quote-unquote unarmed attacker. Nobody ever stops to consider whether an unarmed attacker is trying to become armed by taking the officer's gun, and that the protection required in the incident would be to shoot that person before they get the gun. Listen more.
All right, Carolyn. Well, when you see the video of the attack on the deputy, you might think this would be an open and shut case. But in the middle of the trial, the judge limited the evidence the jury was allowed to consider, in part because of what was not on that recording. Now the deputy says she's furious. The man seen on video attacking her has been released from jail.
I'm just very conflicted. I'm confused. I'm angry, I'm sad.
Former San Bernardino Sheriff's Deputy Megan McCarthy says she can't believe that a jury acquitted the man seen in this video who attacked her, finding him not guilty last week of attempted murder and of assault on a police officer with a gun. That man, Ari Young, was shot by other deputies who arrived to help McCarthy. He recovered, went on trial, and has now been released from jail.
This is just how I feel. If a video proof of a crime occurring is not enough to change a narrative that people hear, then what will be enough?
This was an illusion. Because when you look at the video, certainly it looks bad.
Young's defense attorney, Raj Maleen, says the video and other evidence at trial showed that even though Young fought with and beat former Deputy McCarthy and took her baton and gun, Maleen says Young never aimed the gun or fired at the deputy. He says there wasn't evidence Young had tried to kill the deputy the way prosecutors initially alleged.
I'm going to pause there to just point something out that you need to know. The defense attorney admits his client beat the officer and fired her gun. Whether it was aimed directly at her or over her head or whatever is irrelevant. Violent, aggravated assault on a peace officer. How is this guy free? But he is.
The court intervened, took that count away, and dismissed it right then and said, the jury's not going to be able to deliberate on that issue or consider that issue because it's not even a close call.
This all happened in September 2019 when McCarthy, then known as Megan Forsberg, was first to respond to a call for help. A woman in Victorville says she needed police to get her son out of her house. McCarthy was first at the scene alone and says the fight started when she began to pat down Young in front of his mother's home.
When I have his hands behind his back and I'm just trying to pat down his pockets, he did not want me to. He became very irate, became upset. He ended up grabbing my wrist, and we fought for a good minute and a half before the video kicks on.
Now, former Deputy McCarthy was given a medical retirement last...
The video, FYI, was from a nearby home. It was like a home ring camera type video. It wasn't a body cam or anything else. That's the reason why it isn't captured until the fight goes in front of this motion camera, just FYI.
...last year, in part because of post-traumatic stress she suffered following the attack, in which her wrist and bones in her face were broken.
A portion of me had accepted that I was about to be murdered.
McCarthy says she remembers struggling with Young and that she considered shooting him as she felt she was being overpowered, and says she remembers thinking about her kids in the moment she was fighting, and says her gun malfunctioned in Young's hand.
He has his hand in the trigger guard with me, so the gun had malfunctioned because of the way that his hand was holding my gun. I didn't know if I had been shot, but I knew I had a little girl at home and I had to fight for her.
Young's defense lawyer says that gun-pointing moment wasn't on the video, and jurors didn't believe it happened that way. Young was convicted of negligent discharge of a gun, but he's already served the sentence for that while he was awaiting trial. San Bernardino prosecutors say they can't comment on the case because it's possible they'll retry him on some of those unresolved counts. The sheriff's department there asked us to call back tomorrow for a response on the case.
So he's free. He's free. He beat up a deputy, disarmed her, took her gun and her baton, fired in her direction as she was fleeing. But because the video doesn't show exactly where the firing, the gun was fired, despite it being happening on video, you can't see exactly where the bullet traveled. The jury was not allowed to consider that. And the fact that he beat her violently and broke bones in her face and in her arm, apparently that's just okay now. 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. We'll be back.
Keeping you informed among the uninformed. Always Right Radio with Bob France on The Answer.
Okay, 1035, Always Right Radio. Thanks for being with us. On AM 1420, The Answer. Great calls so far. If you would like to get in, let's do it now because I got Jack Windsor a half an hour from now. So we got the next 25 minutes together for your calls at 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110, especially if you want to react to that. This is definitely one of the stories that I'm going to be covering on True Blue, True Blue Today. If you have not, season one wrapped, and we are in the middle, I think we're four episodes in of producing season two of True Blue Today. That's my television program on the True Blue Factual Streaming Network. If you have not yet downloaded it, do so, or subscribe to it, I should say. It's cheap. It's like $4.99 a month. It's like a fourth of the cost of Netflix, something like that. Anyway, I host that television program. Just go to watchtrueblue.com. You can get it there, watchtrueblue.com. And we talk about crimes. We talk about policing in America. We talk about fundamental fairness, and we talk about what cops face. And this is going to be definitely one of those stories. If you have thoughts on it, you want to comment, again, we'll take your calls. 216-901-0945. Meantime, I'm going to come back to Ohio now and talk about this Ohio Higher Education Enhancement Act. Now, this is, of course, a very important bill that we have discussed on the program before. It's Senator Jerry Serino's bill to try to bring some sense of, fairness? Is that the right word? Or just opportunity for different viewpoints and different ideologies to be expressed on Ohio's college campuses? The college campuses are so left wing, it's not even funny. We're talking 90-95% of the college professors, when polled anonymously, say that they either vote or donate to or both Democrat. They have no tolerance whatsoever for words that they disagree with. They have no tolerance for ideas that do not comport with DIE, that's diversity, inclusion, and equity, that do not comport with cultural Marxism, and worse. If you say that America is a fundamentally great country rather than a fundamentally racist country, an irredeemably racist country, you get zeros. We all know the drill. So this bill is intended to try to even the scale a little bit. And there was a wonderful piece written by Ted Diodin, who is retired now, but he still contributes once in a while to The Plain Dealer. And I read Ted Diodin's piece. He's a member of the editorial board still at The Plain Dealer, even though he's not an active journalist anymore or columnist. He's still on the board, and he wrote a piece on this that I want to share several portions of. I asked him to come on. Ted, I asked Ted to come on a few different times. He's one of the few rational, reasonable, dare I say conservative, but I'd probably not go that far because I don't think he would like that. He's just fair. He's what a journalist is supposed to be, non-biased. He's unbiased and he's willing, objective and willing to express things, you know, maybe that some other people would not, you know, in a left-wing newspaper like The Plain Dealer. So that's one of the reasons I've invited him on in the past. And he just said flat out, I'm not comfortable talking. I'm not comfortable with the radio idea. He said, I kind of make my points through print, and that's kind of where I'd like to keep it. And I totally understood and respect that. But I still reached out to him to thank him for this piece because I said, I'm going to quote you a lot in this discussion. Much of the time you read, when you read or hear about the liberal bias that exists on today's college campuses, it's accompanied by the words alleged or perceived or purported. Indeed, the headline and opening paragraph of a recent Cleveland.com story on the anti-bias Ohio Higher Education Enhancement Act that is currently making its way through the legislature refers to the perceived liberal bias in our universities. You got to work pretty hard to be skeptical about whether liberal or progressive, politically correct, woke, whatever you want to call it, domination holds overwhelming sway across our nation's campuses. And in fact, you don't have to work hard at all to find evidence of liberal bias and its cousin, the proliferation of DIE, training that is being rammed down the throats of the college staff, faculty, and often used as a filter for anyone hoping to be hired on. And that part, I should stop right there and point out, is fundamentally unconstitutional. It is discriminatory. It is discriminatory per the Civil Rights Act to not hire somebody that isn't sufficiently woke, to not hire somebody that isn't DIE compliant. But they use it. They just don't use it overtly. What that means is they won't put it on a rejection letter. It's because you're not woke enough. They can't do that. But they will just, you know, kind of filter them out for other reasons. The relatively small percentage of conservatives on college faculties and the few students willing to admit their conservative leanings certainly believe it, to wit. So he gives these examples, does Ted Diodin. A wide-ranging 2021 report by University of London professor and political scientist Eric Kaufman, conducted by the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology, showed, among much else, that 70% of conservative scholars self-censor, shying away from comments that might go against the liberal consensus just to protect their jobs. 70% of conservative scholars self-censor. How can we live in a free democratic republic like the United States of America under the First Amendment to the Constitution if people have to self-censor simply because they know what's going to happen if they express their opinions, their ideology, their views? How can that be? How can we live that way and still call ourselves a free republic? It's my belief that you can't. As he revealed in a 2021 op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, a political scientist and professor Kaufman found that in the humanities, academics on the left in the United States and Canada outnumber those on the right by a ratio of 14 to 1. So it is no mystery why more liberals than conservatives might be drawn to the humanities. But the troubling thing is the strong instinct among too many liberals to censor or punish those in the minority who hold opposing political views. A Newsweek story Ted writes, about the study cited Kaufman's findings that one in four academics believe their colleagues who express contrary opinions on political issues, like restricting immigration, for one example, should be fired. They believe they should be fired for having a different opinion. All of these people who push for diversity, 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 want diversity of everything except thought. A diverse thought, a differing point of view, is grounds for termination. Kaufman said his research showed that 40% of American academics said they would not hire a known Donald Trump supporter. Another study by the National Association of Scholars that recorded 65 instances of professors being disciplined or fired over something they had said or written. And examples are everywhere, not just in the humanities. Ted Diadem writes, at MIT, of all places, 40% of the faculty there say they're more likely to self-censor than they were just 2 years ago. 41% of students say they are not confident in the administration's ability to protect controversial speech, according to a recent Wall Street op-ed. And controversial speech, of course, is it's an objective term, or subjective term, rather. Because what is controversial to one might not be to another. It's just that it's perceived by the left as being different than their speech or their thoughts. They call it controversial, and thus people are afraid to say it because they don't know if they'd be protected or not. So they self-censor. At Georgetown, another example by Ted Dieden, constitutional law expert Ilya Shapiro's 2021 hiring as a senior lecturer, we covered this story, an executive director at the university's Center for the Constitution, was put on hold when he inartfully tweeted that President Joe Biden was focused on nominating a lesser black woman to the Supreme Court rather than the objectively best pick. He was eventually reinstated only because he wasn't an employee when he made the offending remark, but declined to work under a cloud and resigned. I'm going to say that one again because you need to have the context there. When he said a lesser black woman, the left painted that as Ilya Shapiro saying that the black is lesser than. Black people, black women are lesser than. He was not saying that a black person is lesser. He was saying this choice of Ketanji Brown Jackson, as you know, this choice was of a lesser qualified potential Supreme Court justice who was chosen only because of her skin color and her sex. Biden made it very clear he was going to appoint a black woman, which means that might not be the best person for the job, but he's going for the diversity here, which means a lesser candidate got the position over a better candidate because of her skin color and her sex. Ilya Shapiro simply pointed that out, and he ended up losing his job there for this. This one is closer to home. At Ohio Northern University in Ada, maybe you're familiar. Law professor Scott Gerber is currently fighting for his job because he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he said that DEI efforts that don't include viewpoint diversity would lead to illegal discrimination in employment and admissions. He's fighting for his job because he said viewpoint diversity should be considered as well. And if it isn't, it would lead to illegal discrimination in employment and admissions. What's wrong with that? Now, I reached out to Scott Gerber yesterday, and Scott Gerber replied to me this morning. He's going to be on the program very, very soon. Don't know exactly which day yet, but he's going to be on the program very soon. We're going to let him tell his story. But you tell me, just based on what you've heard, is a statement that DEI efforts that don't include viewpoint diversity leading to illegal discrimination in employment and admissions, is that a fireable offense? They're trying. There is not a thing in the world wrong with diversity, equity, or inclusion as words, ideas, values, or goals, writes Ted Dieden. The problem arises when DEI dogma is used as a bludgeon to force people to mouth platitudes they may not fully believe or to exclude them if they resist. And there is the key. This is why I work as a volunteer with the CFFS, Citizens for Free Speech. And they're actually the National Communications Director, because this kind of stuff needs to be exposed. This is a direct attack on the First Amendment. It literally silences people because they think differently than the massive majority that have been hired on because they think the same. Put that, you know, think about that for a moment. People are being fired for thinking differently than people who got hired, excuse me, solely because they all think the same. That's called groupthink, and it's very, very dangerous. Here's another example from Texas Tech University. Ted Dieden writes, a search committee penalized a candidate for espousing race neutrality in teaching. Excuse me one second. A search committee penalized a candidate for espousing race neutrality. A Wall Street Journal op-ed from February by John Saylor of the National Association of Scholars quotes the evaluation as noting that the candidate, quote, mentioned that DEI is not an issue because he respects his students and treats them equally. This indicates a lack of understanding of equity and inclusion issues. Let me say that again. A professor was penalized, or a candidate was penalized, because in his evaluation, he said he sees and respects all of his students and treats them equally. He was penalized for that. Because treating people equally is no longer the goal in the woke U.S. of A. Treating people equally is considered to be harmful. You have to treat people unequally. You have to provide favoritism for people based on their skin color and or their identification and or their ethnicity. You can't be treating people equally. What the hell is the matter with you? Equality is such an outdated concept. You must treat them with their skin color and their social justice scores in mind. If they come from a marginalized group, you will not treat them equally to everybody else. You will give them benefits. In other words, you will give them privilege. The American left is so all up in a tizzy about privilege, white privilege, male privilege, straight privilege, and so forth. And yet their goal, their answer to that is to give privilege. Not to say there should be no privilege, everybody should be treated equally, that we should flip the script and privilege should be transferred from one to another based on their skin color. In the wake of all this, writes Ted Dieden for Cleveland.com, Senator Jerry Serino of Kirtland, the prime sponsor of the Ohio Higher Education Enhancement Act, the bill aims at making state-funded colleges and universities safe for First Amendment rights among conservative faculty and students. The bill passed the Senate. It's currently awaiting debate in the House. It's simply designed, said Serino, to ensure free expression on campus and in the classroom. We talked to Jerry Serino about this a couple of weeks ago. Among other things, the bill would end mandated diversity training. It wouldn't prohibit it, but it would end a mandate saying if you work for the university, you, and even if you study at the university, you must attend diversity training. That's horse crap. And I'm glad this bill would prevent such mandates. It would prevent colleges from using DEI as a litmus test in hiring. It would prohibit gifts from China or organizations acting on behalf of the communist Chinese government. It would prevent faculty and staff from striking during labor disputes. It would add a required government course for all students that includes reading and understanding the Constitution. That's a winner right there. That's something that every student, not to sit here and puff my chest out over this, but my daughter, of course, just graduated from Hillsdale. Every student must take. It is mandatory to get a degree from Hillsdale, a course on the Constitution. This would also mandate a course that would include reading and understanding the Declaration of Independence, the Emancipation Proclamation, the Federalist Papers, Gettysburg Address, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. But the main thrust of the bill is directed at protecting intellectual diversity, ensuring that nobody is censured or punished or for expressing opinions on a wide range of social, political, and religious topics. It requires an official affirmation from the institution that such freedom will be protected. And as you know, predictably, as Ted Dianon writes, liberal institutions across the state and most media have criticized the bill. They don't like the idea of a First Amendment that actually protects speech. They don't believe in freedom of speech. They believe in freedom of left-wing speech and the silencing, the censoring, and then the censuring of those on the ideological right. The bill is about adhering to the Chicago principles, true diversity of opinion, no indoctrination, teaching students how to think and analyze. Not liberal, not conservative, everyone. How can opponents of this bill be against more diversity? Asked Jerry Serino. He said he was stung by the criticism he's received, including his alleged depiction of the bill's opponents as clowns. I did use that word, he said, but that was not my complete comment. We listened to 7.5 hours of testimony from opponents of the bill, and most were respectful and well-meaning. A small number were rude and disrespectful, including one tenured professor from Miami University who gave me the middle finger as he left. Those were the ones I called clowns. I will wrap this, Ted Dianon, by thanking you for this terrific piece you wrote that I've been quoting from. And I will amend Senator Jerry Serino's words. They are all clowns, Senator. All of them. Anybody who opposes, even respectfully, free speech in America and the opportunity for conservative students and faculty to be admitted or hired and heard when they're on campus, anybody who opposes that is a clown. All right? They have absolutely no regard whatsoever for the Constitution and thus the principles of this country. Colleges and universities almost all proclaim their commitment to academic freedom, Serino said. But they don't mean it. We see that in the effective prohibition of debate on contentious topics and in what is now called compelled speech. And we see it when college authorities turn a blind eye to the bullying and shoutdowns that so often foreclose expression of disfavored views, end quote. There are too many cases of campus bullying, writes Ted Dianon, both in Ohio and around the nation, and Serino's bill is a step in the right direction. Could not agree more. Terrific work. Thank you, Ted Dianon. Thank you to Jerry Serino, and obviously, I welcome your thoughts on it, too. 216-901-0945. Right back. Okay, it's coming up on 10:59, so just a minute to go in the segment. Then after the top of the hour, Jack Windsor's going to come in, the editor-in-chief and the founder of the Ohio Press Network. Jack and I are going to talk about a couple of things. Senate Bill 83. We're going to talk about House Bill 183. We're going to talk about Issue 1. Do you know that we're 34 days away from early voting for the special election on August 8th? There is early voting. It's 34 days away, and that's when we absolutely must come together and vote yes on Issue 1 to raise that constitutional threshold to 60%. It's extraordinarily important. So Jack Windsor and I are going to talk about all of those things and maybe a little bit more, whether or not, well, I'm just going to save some of this for you because we got a great conversation to come. So Jack will join me at about 11:10. We'll have a news break now. Come right back on Always Right Radio, AM 1420, The Answer. And then the man steps right up
to the microphone. This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by KeepingMedicareSimple.com and The Floor King.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay, there is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This
is Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
Onward we roll into hour number three. It's 10 minutes after 11 o'clock on a Wednesday, the seventh morning of the sixth month, otherwise known as the month of groom, in the year of our Lord 2023. Appreciate you being with us, and always appreciate the opportunity to talk with the ever-popular Jack Windsor. Jack Windsor, of course, is the founder and the editor of the Ohio Press Network. He is also our State House correspondent for AM 1420, The Answer in Columbus. He's doing radio work down in Columbus as well, and he brings his fans with him wherever he goes. I shouldn't say you bring them with you, Jack. I mean, it's not your fault. They follow you around. They're just loyal, and their allegiance to you is unquestioned. So welcome back to the program, my friend. How are you?
Bob, I'm super fantastic. Great to be here with you today. Thanks for having me.
As always, my friend. Okay, Jack Windsor, let's dive into some of the news. We have a lot to get into. First of all, I want to start with one of the headline stories right now on the Ohio Press Network, which, of course, you founded and are the executive editor of. Or editor-in-chief, I guess, would be the right title. You tell me. So, Jack, Ohio Senate includes universal school choice and flatter tax in its budget. Let's talk about the budget that the Senate wants to get through, because it's a little bit different than the House version in terms of universal funding for school choice. What can you tell us?
Well, it has more choice. It stops short of universal choice, but it allows for families who earn $135,000 to qualify for full school choice scholarships. Now, families above that will be means tested and scholarships adjusted, but every student would be eligible for at least a 10% scholarship under the Senate budget proposal.
And what is your understanding, you know, when you talk about the differences? I know your finger is on the pulse of a lot of the General Assembly in Columbus. There are differences. Which side is more likely to bend to the other, House or Senate?
Man, let's have that discussion. First of all, the question that I want answered, and this is what I'm asking, I've sent a note to Matt Huffman's guy there in the Senate. I've got some questions out to Senator Andrew Brenner from the Delaware area. I want to understand what full school choice scholarship means. What does that amount, right? Because here's the deal. Originally, the backpack bill was going to get done. One of the things that we heard when Jason Stevens stole the gavel from Derek Marin was that he was going to make sure that didn't happen. And, oh, by the way, it's not happening. So here's the weird part. The interplay between the Senate and the House, we can talk about this. I don't know how far in the weeds you want to go about it. You know, the Senate, to me, is pretty formidable at this point. The House, given that it is a Republican supermajority, certainly doesn't look or act like it. In fact, floor sessions were canceled again this week. There's a lot of scuttlebutt about Jason Stevens being concerned that when he is in session that he may be vacated. So he's really trying to keep a tight lid on who he recognizes, calling only on the people that support him. Now, that is the rumor. I can't confirm that. But, you know, Jason's kind of between a rock and a hard place. He's put 12, I think there were 12 priority bills out in January. None of them have gotten over the finish line. Keep in mind, 67 Republicans occupy that 99-member chamber. So a lot of people are going, what are you guys doing over there? Right now, the Senate is probably the more powerful of the two chambers.
We're talking to Jack Windsor. He is the executive. Jack, I'm sorry, correct me. Is it editor-in-chief?
Editor-in-chief, founding editor. Yep.
I just want to be. I want to make
cook, bottle washer, hostess. You know, all of it.
You do a little bit of everything. I respect that, but no. The most important part: the editor in chief and the founder of the Ohio Press Network. And there's great information on that Senate bill there, Jack. Let's talk about other or on the budget bills. Let's talk about a couple of other ones, both of them with 83s. Yep. We have 183 and we have 83. The Senate side is 83. I just read a very extensive piece or portions of it from Ted Dieden's view of this on Cleveland.com. This is Senator Jerry Serino's bill to try to at least bring some semblance of fairness to college campuses when it comes to diversity of thought. As we all know, it is a very, very radical left-wing place to be on a college campus, not just in Ohio, but around the country. Senator Serino's bill would at least give people with conservative viewpoints an opportunity to be heard without fear of being canceled, an opportunity to be heard without fear of being rejected for a spot in a class, a faculty member from being fired or you know, reprimanded in some other way. And the left is going crazy about this. I'm just looking at the, if you Google up Ohio Senate bill, not Google. I don't use Google. I use DuckDuckGo. If you search up Ohio Senate bill 83, you're going to get a whole bunch of things like this, a chilling effect, how SB 83 could change Ohio's education system. There are letters and op-eds in here talking about how horrible it is to give something that they claim they champion to thought, and that is diversity. They champion diversity in all realms except for diversity of thought, diversity of ideas, diversity of opinions, Jack. So Senate Bill 83 would seem to me anyway, to be a no-brainer. Yes, everybody should have an opportunity to be heard without fear of retribution, but there is a significant amount of opposition to this. Your thoughts?
My thoughts. Can we talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room first?
Sure.
The people who oppose this bill are the same people I'm old enough to remember them, who wanted to throw masks on everybody and require that they get a shot. And they were fine with that, even if there were negative health consequences. Now they want the government out of their situation. It's perplexing, isn't it? So Serino's bill, primarily the function, as it's stated, is that schools would list or, I don't know, tell people and stand behind their primary function being the pursuit of knowledge, not political activism, but the pursuit of knowledge. It's been pitched as creating accountabilities in colleges, as you stated, to keep political activism in check, even tenured professors. And it would require things like a syllabus to be posted online. It would prohibit relationships with communist Chinese government. And it says that it would prohibit any mandatory programs or training courses requiring DEI. Now, this is what I would encourage every Ohioan to do, especially the people who are squawking about this bill. Go to the ohiolegislature.gov and read the summary. There's a 29-page bill summary. This bill is extensive. There are a lot of things in it. But even if you're celebrating it, you got to really dive in and ask yourself some questions regarding diversity, equity, and inclusion. It says that you can't mandate that those programs except and unless the school would receive an exemption if such program or course is required for certain specified purposes. Okay, what are the exemptions and what are the qualifying specified purposes? It also calls for policies on equal opportunities to treat all faculty, staff, and students as individuals, hold all individuals to equal standards, and provide every individual with equality of opportunity, which, by the way, is not equity of outcome, with regard to those individuals' race, ethnicity, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. Okay, but what's gender expression? And what protections should be afforded gender identity and expressions? Those are things that this bill really needs to, I think, vet out. And this is in the Higher Education Committee. My understanding after talking with lawmakers last night is that this probably won't get any action prior to that chamber summer break.
Which, again, is very, very frustrating to me because with all due respect to everything you just said and all of the opinions on the other side of this whole thing, I mean, this really should be a no-brainer. Now, I might question, and the next time I talk to Senator Serino, I'll ask him this, but, you know, mixing in the, you know, do not strike provisions, you know, no striking provisions, the China provision. I mean, not that these things aren't important, but maybe they should be standing on their own as a part and apart from this this particular bill. And let's just stick with, you know, what we're trying to accomplish here, which is, again, freedom of speech and freedom of thought and the freedom from being mandated to take diversity courses to make you think a way that you do not think, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If maybe we just kind of narrow scope this thing down a little bit, maybe it'll have a better chance, or am I off?
No, I think it will, and I think it would be more favorable to teachers' unions, who are a very powerful lobby in Columbus, by the way. So that might make it more palatable. Bob, I would be remiss. I want to go back, and I'm sorry to do this. I forgot to mention a really important part of that Senate version of the budget. I talked to Scott Lipps last night. He said that The House added his bills, 739 and 747. Those are the ones that they're separate. K through 12 and colleges and universities would be prohibited from mandating vaccines. Those two bills are still in the Senate version. I wanted to add that as well.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thanks, Jack. Let's move on from Senate Bill 83 to House Bill 183. And this is just kind of being called, in a general sense, the bathroom bill, which we have seen in a lot of other places as well. The Attorney General on Friday, Dave Yost, issued a legal opinion and said that government-owned public facilities have the right to say boys in boys' bathrooms, girls in girls' bathrooms. What else can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that that kind of goes against what school lawyers were telling superintendents and boards of education, saying, hey, that Bostock case, that landmark Supreme Court case, allows you to boys into girls' restrooms, so on and so forth. You said, not so fast. No, it doesn't. And Ohio law doesn't forbid that. Well, but the law is the law. And so House Bill 183 comes on the heels of Yost's opinion, which, by the way, will give it a legal foundation to stand on, because a lot of people are going to argue, well, you can't do it. And Yost said, no, I just weighed in. You can do it. House Bill 183, it regards single-sex bathroom access in primary and secondary schools and institutions of higher education. It was given a bill number last week. It will be into committee this week. I had a chance to catch up with State Representative Beth Lear, and you might have some footage there, Bob, of what she told me about the bill.
Yeah, I might, Jack, and I don't have it queued up at this exact moment, though, but I do want to hear that because I did listen to it. I'm going to ask you to bear with me here and take a time out. I want to come back.
Yep.
I want to also hit a little bit more on 183, and then, Jack, before we're done, if you can stick with us, we have to talk about issue one. We are 34 days away from early voting being cast on the very special election on August 8th, so I want to hit that, too. So stay with us. We're going to hear more from Jack Windsor right after this on Always Right Radio. Okay, 11:26 now. Let's continue with Jack Windsor. And Jack and I were just discussing House Bill 183, which is sometimes known as the bathroom bill. And Jack, you wanted to set up this Beth Lear chat that you had.
Yeah, so I was talking with the superintendent and a school board president over the weekend, and we were talking about this issue of single-sex facilities. And, you know, they're in favor of it. The challenge that they've run into is they have to find ways around the barn, right, and ways to circumvent some things to keep themselves out of court. So House Bill 183 comes at a time when school districts are going, hey, we really want to separate boys and girls. Because, by the way, you know, sexual assault, voyeurism, it's generally males perpetrating that against females. So I caught up with Beth Lear and I said, well, what does House Bill 183 do? And here's what she had to say.
So I took that bill upon his death and went ahead and talked with my friend Adam Bird, the chairman of the Education Committee, who's a former superintendent, by the way. And he and I decided we were going to share sponsorship for a bill that would say no boys and girls will be sharing bathrooms, locker rooms, changing rooms, or overnight accommodations in K through 12 or higher ed publicly funded schools if we can get this bill to pass.
So go ahead, Jack, follow that up.
Yeah, so and it's important that the context that I guess bolsters that is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost coming out last week and issuing an opinion that says the Bostock case nor Ohio law would prohibit that from happening. So this bill has a clear runway, and with a Republican supermajority in the House and Senate, it absolutely should be a no-brainer.
Jack, let's pivot in the 2 minutes we have left to issue one. And I know you also talked to Republican Party Chair Alex Triantafilou as well about this. Tell me where we are 34 days away.
Yeah, where we are 34 days away is that everybody's
I should say,
this about...
to be clear, I should say from early voting. Early voting begins in 34 days. The actual official election day is August 8th. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so everyone's making this about abortion, 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 right? But it's important to tease out. There are two separate things here. There is an abortion amendment initiative that is going to get 414,000 signatures by July 5th, so it will likely be on the ballot in November. If we have 30 seconds at the end, I'll talk about what that is versus what the press is saying it is. But the August special election, it would simply do one thing. It would require a 60% approval in order to amend the state's constitution. Federally, it takes almost 67% in Congress, and it takes 75% of states to ratify a constitutional amendment, which is why it's only been amended 17 times since the Bill of Rights. Ohio's constitution has been amended over 100 times. And the challenge that we run into is that it's not just about abortion, regardless of what Morgan Trowell wants to say at News Channel 5. It's about Second Amendment rights. It's about minimum wage laws. It's about marijuana recreational use. And if you don't have a passion point yet, it's coming, because the way that activists are using the Constitution at a 50% threshold is they're, you know, pulling up a truck of money and they're creating language that's really broad. And then they're getting their friends in the press to say what they want them to say it is. And then they're putting a ton of money into marketing to tell voters what they want them to think it is. Case in point is this constitutional amendment in November, where spokespeople for it are saying,
Let me interrupt you there, Jack. Can you stick through the news?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't want you to rush what you're about to say. It's extraordinarily important. Again, and I also want to hear the conversation you had with Alex Durantafilou. So we'll continue with Jack Windsor after this time out on Always Right Radio.
Always Right Radio on The Answer.
Okay, it's 11:33. I've got one more segment here with Jack Windsor, who's been kind enough to stay on. I told you we had a lot to talk about. We've already talked about three bills, and we still haven't even gotten to the core of issue one. So Jack Windsor, the executive editor and, I'm sorry, I did it again, the editor-in-chief and the founder of the Ohio Press Network, has been interviewing and talking to a number of leaders in Columbus. So, Jack, you had a conversation with the new chairman of the Republican Party in the state of Ohio, Alex Durantafilou. What do we have?
Well, I wanted to talk with Alex about several things, particularly this August special election. You know, we've been told that it's about abortion, right? That the only reason that Republicans and Frank LaRose are pushing this forward is that they want to stave off this radical November ACLU Planned Parenthood-backed attempt to amend the Constitution. And here's what Alex said about that.
One of the things that we've heard a lot about is abortion, abortion, abortion. It's about abortion. Well, certainly it's about that. But isn't it about more than that? Aren't there other issues that could potentially come down the pike? And I'm certain that there are things that, if it's not abortion, that people are passionate about that might be under attack next.
That's exactly right. You'll see things like mandatory minimum wage. You'll see other things that come down. Again, what we've allowed to happen in this state is special interest dollars flow into the state. They don't go to the legislature. They don't go to the deliberative body, Jack, that's designed to evaluate the quality of legislation, to evaluate what impact a change in the law will have on the citizenry, which is what, again, we're a republic for this reason. We elect people to go and do the business of the government and evaluate whether something makes sense for you. They have hearings. There's an entire process. Well, the way that's happened here in Ohio way too often is you get special interest money just dumping millions of dollars in television advertising and bypassing that entire process. So they'll do this, to answer your question, with a litany of other things that just aren't right for Ohio. So for that reason, again, we ought to be for a yes on issue one.
So Jack Windsor, a yes on issue one, and obviously in August, but then no on the November issue. Tell us a little bit more about what is specifically in the November will be in that ballot initiative.
Well, the November ballot initiative it's pushed by groups like ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and abortionists in Ohio as codifying abortion rights. Well, in fact, abortion rights, they already exist in Ohio in the law. So they're in the code. There's a heartbeat law that does not allow for abortion up to the time a child has a heartbeat. And there are exceptions beyond that time to account for the mother's life risks. That law has been paused by Christian Jenkins. He's a Democrat. He's a judge in Hamilton County. So as it stands, abortion is permissible in the state at 21 to 22 weeks. So it doesn't codify. It's already codified. What it does is the initiative intentionally puts language into the Constitution that it's broad, and it allows for abortions on demand up to the birth for reasons such as, I don't know, mom's financial stress, mm-hmm. Maybe she has anxiety, maybe her social health will be impinged, literally. So if an abortion doctor says, you know what, that's a valid reason, we can abort this child up to birth. Now, why is that important? Because Ohioans passed a law that said after a heartbeat is present, we don't want you to kill a kid. And right now it's at 21 to 22 weeks. Do we really want abortion in Ohio up to 9 months? So we need to really be honest about what this does. The language is also broad enough, Bob, that it talks about reproductive health rights, not being able to be impinged by the government. What does that mean? Well, that means if you have a confused minor male, for example, biological male, who is under political and peer pressure to identify as a female. Well, answer this hard question. If that child takes, I don't know, puberty blockers or hormones, or worse, wants to get his genitalia lopped off, what does that mean? Is that a reproductive health decision? It certainly would seem like that to me. Well, the language in this November ballot initiative would allow that to happen without parental consent, as well as killing a child in the womb. So this is a really radical amendment that the press is doing a really poor job of reporting on, and that the purveyors of it aren't really being honest about, which goes back to why August is really important. Do you want people being duped and voting at 51% to put something this radical in our Constitution?
Okay, great explanation, Jack. So trying to double back a little bit now, we'll come back to August now. Frank LaRose, you mentioned him twice, and you mentioned News Channel 5. It's not just News Channel 5, that was one of the many places, but the Ohio Capital Journal. Virtually every left-wing media outlet is all over Twitter and social media saying, aha, he said it out loud. Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, who has come out in support of the ballot, in issue one in August, and then against the ballot initiative in November, he has said this is 100% about preventing an abortion, radical abortion law from being put into the Constitution. So they're saying that he is not only is he not unbiased in this case, but that he has lied. He has said many, many times that this is about much bigger things, as Alex Giantafilou did and as you just did. But he specifically said this is solely 100% about abortion. What does that do to this cause, in your opinion?
Well, I think it confuses it and it muddies it, right? So if that's the route that they want to take, then they should also be intellectually honest enough to report what it is and what it isn't. If you're going to make it all about abortion, then let's talk about what that is and what you're actually trying to do. What you're trying to do is allow abortion on demand up until birth and allow it to happen with minors without parental consent. You're trying to push for minor children to be transitioned chemically or otherwise, procedurally, without parental consent. Call that what it is. If you do that, I don't think that thing passes. But here's the issue. Bob, you have experience.
Well, what I'm basically asking you, if I may, Jack, is did Frank LaRose hurt the cause by stating it the way that he is being quoted as having stated it?
You know, I don't know that he hurt the cause. I mean, to me, I read that and I go, well, In order for something to be ripe for adjudication, to be considered by a judge in court, certain things have to be present, right? There has to be an impetus for that to be decided. Well, this is the impetus. It absolutely. It's a radical amendment, and we just talked about what it is. So is he saying, yeah, 100%, this is the impetus to get it done, and by the way, here are the other reasons it needs to get done. I mean, is that a gotcha moment? I don't think so. News Channel 5 does, the Ohio Capital Journal does, but you know, they're waiting in the weeds, always looking for a gotcha moment, with things that are opposed to, you know, what their agenda is, which is progressivism and government control.
Yeah, and you know, to a point you made, Jack, just briefly about the actual initiative, and you mentioned, you know, a boy, is it a reproductive health issue to have, you know, those things done? And it is, but you may or may not know, and people may or may not know, the overwhelming number of young people wishing to transition is actually teenage girls transitioning to boys. They are the ones who are under the most peer pressure. They're the ones who are suffering the most from the quote-unquote online influencers and other people in their lives that are telling them, and that's why they're going together in groups to get their therapy and to get their hormones. They're going to doctors, seeing doctors, you know, it clearly they're not feeling doing these things themselves without the support and encouragement of one another. And there is a huge number of them who want to transition to male. And the moment they start taking the puberty blockers there, Jack, as females, they are rendering themselves infertile. They are not going to be able to get pregnant and carry children when they get over this weird little social contagion that they're dealing with right now. And that absolutely is something that a parent should be involved in, helping a young minor decide whether or not they want to forego the ability to have children in the future. That alone should be enough reason to defeat that initiative in November.
Yeah, it absolutely should. And by the way, for the people who say, well, that's not what's in there. Yes, it does. It actually says every individual has a right to make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions, including but not limited to decisions on ... And then it goes on to. So that's broad. It's saying there are also other things that we will later allow the courts and, you know, the legislature to decide what is that reproductive health decision. So, yes, it does fall under that umbrella. And here's the issue, Bob. I don't know what the number is. It's small. When you think of a bell curve, like a statistical curve, yeah. These are outliers. The men that want to transition to women and women that want to transition to men, it's a small amount. But when you look at the uptick over the past couple of years, you go, well, it's obvious that there's political pressure that is influencing these kids. It is the trendy thing right now. To be all, you know, rainbowed up and to do the thing that the school board wants you to do, the teachers want you to do, the teachers unions are supporting, and kids that probably have some issues or instability in their life are using this as a coping mechanism. And so when it might be 1% otherwise, but it's 20% now, then you should really pump the brakes and go, wait a minute, this kid's frontal lobe won't develop until she's 25 years old. Why are we allowing her at, you know, eighth grade to make a decision that would render her infertile for the rest of her life? It's asinine. It's crazy. I can't comprehend it. And in fact, there are families that are, you know, pro LGBTQ, who have come out and said, no, this is not right. My daughter went through this process, and the way that the community that promotes this deals with this is dishonest. It's not healthy. And we need to pump the brakes on this. And, it's an important issue. And I hope, probably beyond hope, that the press would actually catch up to what the reality is, start reporting so that Ohioans can make an educated decision, because I think people will make a good choice when they have the facts.
That's the last thing that the press wants, is an educated populace. There's no doubt about it. They're proven by their actions and by their slanted journalism, which is why the Ohio Press Network is so important, by the way. I encourage everybody to subscribe to the Ohio Press Network online, theohiopressnetwork.com. That's Jack's very important publication. Jack Windsor, great explanation. You covered it top to bottom, and there's still a lot of work to be done. We'll look forward to talking to you again very soon.
God bless you, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. God bless you, too. That's it. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Jack Windsor. Thanks to my team, Josh and Marianne and Marcy. And thanks to you for being a part of the show today as well. We'll see you tomorrow. Dr. Everett Piper will be here. Be well. Be safe. Stay free. See you then.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.